In writing these reflections, I have not thought of those who reject Christian morality. I can imagine their astonishment if they should happen to fall by this article. Such an effort to solve a problem that really doesn't exist at all. They will say, it is useless to argue with them. They live in another world. They do not attach the same value to words or sentiments as we do. In the moral universe they inhabit, the laws of gravity operate differently. They seem more elastic. But they are also of less value. The bitter fruits that are sometimes the result of their dexterity and easy manipulation of the moral law are not worth our consideration. So much perversion, unhappiness and vacuity of soul. Indeed, their heroism is a heroism stripped of its supernatural character. In compensation, I have often thought of our many young homes. Marriages are earlier today, and that is evidence of health. But it would not be good if these marriages were too little prepared. Young people, in contracting premature unions, simplify their moral life by finding an easy means of evading the struggle for purity. But if the number of children increases regularly, they run the risk of a frustrated middle age. It is not sufficient that they elaborate a program of life at the time of their marriage that is usually blatantly unreal. For the sake of the dignity of the vocation they have chosen, they should be counseled that Christian marriage is an uphill road, and that the incline is arduous. I have thought, too, of the many unhappy homes in our slums for whom the practice of virtue is only too evidently impossible considering the frightful conditions of their life. There is here a very real conflict between generosity and prudence. Charity binds us to understand the difficulties of Christian life in such circumstances. We would be dishonest if we let our personal problems cloud over for even a minute the injustice of so much unhappiness. We are all jointly responsible. We should feel to the marrow of our bones the misery of a world that condemns men to moral disorder. The best way to solve, or at least to diminish, our problems, and to see them as they really are, is to compare them with those of others and to wage war upon all forms of misery. Chapter V. The Flesh and the Spirit. It cannot be denied that the flesh holds an important place in conjugal love. We must not exaggerate it, although many married couples, especially in the beginning of their married life, experience the fire of physical union to such an extent that they can master only with difficulty its all-pervading reality. Priests and educators are frequently asked, and sometimes asked with anxiety, what place must we give to the flesh? What attitude does Christianity indicate? The answers are not always in agreement, and the different currents of thought that Christian tradition presents on this point do not simplify a problem that is already difficult. The celebrated sentence of François Mauriac, "Christianity does not give the flesh its rightful place, but suppresses it," translates an attitude that is fairly widespread in certain Christian milieu as a consequence of Jansenism and also of certain pessimistic thoughts in Saint 107. Augustine. From there, it is only a step to saying that the flesh corrupts the spirit, that it is always a danger, a threat and a principle of corruption. Is the flesh then an enemy that must be strangled? Christian doctrine, in its totality, does not think so. Rather, it affirms that the flesh, far from being suppressed, must be evangelized and redeemed just as the soul. A sane philosophy is here indispensable. Let us recall that man is not made of two contradictory and divergent elements, the body and the soul. He is a body animated by a soul, this soul being incarnate. Man is a whole, a unity. Any dualistic formula pretending that the creature God made in his image is composed of two juxtaposed or even opposed realities is to be rejected. What is true, that the hierarchy that should normally exist for human equilibrium and the advantage of the soul, is contradicted by the fact of sin. Hear the words of Saint Paul, take on all of their meaning. The flesh, instead of being subordinated to the spirit, militates against it and constantly endangers the harmony of the splendid image of God. The rebellions of the flesh, its demands which at certain moments can appear tyrannic, the difficulties it sets in the way of spiritualizing effects of grace, must not be judged therefore on a purely philosophical basis. The human condition is determined by two historical events, sin and redemption. If a cord between the flesh and the spirit is a laborious conquest, it is because the human condition, which is that of a redeemed sinner, is itself the work of long and exacting preparation in which the treasures of grace and the generous response of created nature must cooperate. Saint Paul's condemnation of the flesh was never unilateral. What he calls flesh is sinful man, it is humanity hypnotized by evil, while spirit symbolizes in his eyes the new creature, body and soul, regenerated in the redemptive blood of Christ. The body itself, which because of certain idolatrous cults of antiquity could become the object of legitimate suspicion on the part of Christians, is magnificently rehabilitated, since the order of redemption not only renders it worthy of association with the soul, but considers it together with the soul a temple of the Holy Spirit. The apostrophe of the Epistle to the Corinthians is just as astonishing today as it was to the readers of the first century. Do you not know that the body is for the Lord and the Lord for the body? Christianity does not thus divide human nature. One of its most formal principles is respect for the nature and the laws of creation. It does not mutilate man, it restores him. It renders the whole man capable of living his life as an image of God. If it cautions us against the deviations of the flesh and its disordinate impulses, as well as against pride of spirit and angelism, it is through fidelity to the creative will of God. To put asunder what God has joined together is to sin both against creation and against the work of Christ who redeemed us, body and soul, at a great price. Thus, everything ultimately depends on the senseth art man consents to give to the flesh. If he judges it from the point of view of an egoist, completely independent of the laws of the universe to which he must submit, he turns it away from its end. The flesh is not sinful, rather man made of it an instrument of sin. If, on the contrary, he freely yields to the order of the world willed by God, if he accepts the facts of existence, creation, sin, redemption, and seeks, with the aid of divine grace, the restoration of fallen humanity, he gives to the flesh its true vocation. He liberates it from the evil with which it is burdened and makes it serve the supreme ideal of love. The conjugal act, its intentions and its qualities. The conjugal act is often a sin, still more often a doubtful and mediocre act, because man deprives it of its meaning. Envisaged as it should be, following the design of God, it can become highly meritorious. It is then more than an act, it is a work. The conjugal act is justified by the ends of marriage, namely, the propagation of the species, the total fulfillment of the partners, and peace of soul and body. It is not then a reprehensible act in itself, to which the sacrament of marriage brings, as though from the outside, a kind of legitimation to permit married people to choose the lesser of two evils. Christian theology, represented here by explicit texts of Saint Thomas Aquinas, affirms that the act of marriage is honorable, that it is moral, and that it is in itself, in its intrinsic finality, that it finds this honor and this morality. Saint Augustine taught the same thing. If concupiscence is evil, says the Bishop of Hippo, since it is the penalty and sting of sin, the conjugal act puts concupiscence itself in the service of good. Pope Innocent XI ratified these doctrinal affirmations. Let us specify that if procreation is impossible, because of involuntary sterility, the two other ends of marriage suffice to justify physical relations in marriage. Finally, let us not forget that the matrimonial consent exchanged on the wedding day, which gives to each partner a right to the body of the other, is a right. The expression conjugal debt often used is exact. Love is not the only consideration here, there is also the question of justice. However, we must recall that if the right exists, its usage is not indispensable to the essence of marriage. If, through mutual agreement, a husband and wife decide to practice perpetual continence, their union is perfectly valid. Therefore, we cannot pretend that conjugal relations are absolutely necessary. Here again, it is the spirit that dominates the flesh and determines the part to be played by sex. With these few principles in mind, let us insist further on the quality of the conjugal act. If it is not sinful in itself, it does not follow that it is always good. It cannot, furthermore, be neither good nor bad. An important principle of Thomistic moral theology is that there is no such thing as an indifferent act. Married couples must therefore know that the spiritual state of their soul confers to their physical relations a certain quality which will serve or destroy their love. As Christians, they can find here an occasion for an increase of grace, or, on the other hand, they can weaken their supernatural vitality. Since all acts of conjugal life, if they are carried out in fidelity to the general intentions of the sacrament, are good and consequently meritorious, the husband and wife must see to it, not only that they are united in the state of grace, but also that the conjugal act never be an animal act, but always a human act. This means I. a spiritual act and therefore a free act. Sex is not merely an outlet for the caprices of instinct. The soul must also express itself through the body. In this case, a human person speaks to another human person in the language of total adhesion and seeks, in the words of Scripture, to know the other through the intermediary of the senses. If there be no spiritual communication of persons, if sensual tyranny is given full rein and satisfaction, if only a delectation, even though legitimate, is sought in reciprocal egoism, what should be a human act becomes frighteningly mutilated. Such an exercise of liberty calls, moreover, for education. The conjugal act can be a free act from the outset, or it can at any time cease to be free. Instinct sometimes obscures the spirit which may believe itself master over the flesh. Even if there be no danger of becoming unduly concerned by disordinate temptations of the sexual instinct, constant vigilance must be maintained. This educative work must be pursued without respite and the grace of God sought, in humble and constant prayer, to assure a virtuous domination of the soul over the senses. We cannot forget that the realities here involved are extremely complex. The flesh remains a mystery. Even when the conjugal act is accomplished in full liberty, it may not be completely subjugated to the veritable development of husband and wife until after long months, or even years, of life together. One of the merits of Dr. Hoovenroo's book Témoignage sur Paix Humaine is to have insisted on the patience required by love. Attentive respect, a certain forgetting of self and a great concern for the good of the other are indispensable to both partners. Nature demands this patience of them. Because of egoism or of precipitation, many homes never know this desired accord in the domain of the carnal. 2. An act of love. The harmony we have been speaking of supposes more than freedom and patience, for it is a work of love. The conjugal act is sometimes the crowning of the union of hearts, and sometimes the means of attaining and deepening this union. Nature has designed it as an exceptional meeting ground of the three ends of marriage, but, without love, it cannot be the magnificent gesture of intimacy and fruitfulness willed by the Creator. As an expression of love and a servant of love, such a union truly becomes a hymn of praise to God. Intimacy is good, fruitfulness is good, since God has made them part of marriage and He has willed that these two aspects be inseparable. But without love, they are a horrible caricature of love. Mutual respect and attention, for which we pleaded earlier in this chapter, has no better guarantee than a delicate love that is in perpetual reference to love itself. The redemptive graces of Christ are here indispensable. We can understand the intransigence of a church that wishes to take the responsibilities only of those marriages she has blessed. The grace of marriage, the grace of a permanent sacrament, heals a wounded nature by helping it against its anarchic impulses. It also saves love by carrying half of its burden and by deepening its quality with all of the resources of divine charity. 3.